Hello. In episode 26 of Airs for Architecture's third series, Loretta Lees and Eleanor Warwick discuss their 2022 book, Defensible Space on the Move, Mobilisation in English Housing Policy and Practice, published by John Wiley & Sons. We talk about not only the what of the enduring concept of defensibility and defensible space, but its origin and assimilation into English policy, practice and language, not least through the efforts of the remarkable Alice Coleman.
A is for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A is for Architecture. I'm talking today to Loretta Lees and Eleanor Warwick about your new book, your recent book, Defensible Space on the Move, Mobilisation in English Housing Policy and Practice, published by Wiley as part of the Royal Geographical Society's book series. It's a wonderful book, and I'm very glad you're here. Thank you ever so much for joining me. Perhaps we could start with some introductions. Loretta, you first.
Okay, hello. So I am Loretta Lees. I'm currently Director of the Initiative on Cities at Boston University in the US. Before that, I worked for 9 years at the University of Leicester in the Geography Department, and about, I think, 16 years at King's College London in the Geography Department. For the 2 years before I came to Boston from 2020 to 2022, I was chair of the London Housing Panel, working with Sadiq Khan and Trust for London. I guess my background is as a trained geographer. I'm specifically an urban geographer, but I guess I would kind of categorize myself as an urbanist. My main kind of areas of research over the years, probably that I'm best known for, are probably around gentrification, although I've also done a lot of work on architecture, urban public space, urban policy, and urban social theory as well. So I've kind of moved around the world in this role. So I got a PhD from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Then I went to New Zealand for a year where I worked as a lecturer in geography. Then I moved to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver in Canada, where I did a Leverhulme funded postdoc for 2.5 years, looking at the kind of downtown redevelopment of Vancouver, and also looking at some of its new architecture, for example, its new public library, which was built by Moshe Zafdi. And after that, I took up my first proper academic job, I guess, in 1997, I think it was, at King's College London. And here I am now.
And now you're in Boston.
Yes.
That's amazing. Amazing. What a wonderful kind of career trajectory. How are you finding Boston?
I mean, it's been fascinating on two different accounts. One, universities here are so different. They're so unaudited, you're not watched over here, so you literally can do whatever you want, which makes things incredibly creative and kind of liberating. But on the other hand, you're kind of coming from the British context, you're kind of desiring a little bit of kind of auditing and management and structure to things. And the city itself is fascinating. It's a really weird kind of mixture of very global, but also quite provincial. So I'm kind of trying to get my head around that conceptually and just in terms of the way things work.
Fantastic. It's really good. Eleanor, your turn.
Oh, thank you. And it's very nice to sort of follow Loretta, who has had a proper geographer's career. I think I was very much a closet geographer, although I didn't even do geography as at O level. I sort of like took history instead. I started out doing architecture, but mainly because I couldn't do theatre design. I didn't get into art school. So I did architecture and went through that whole long sort of like drawn out training. And I actually practiced for about 10 years building schools and hospitals and even housing, until I became a bit demoralized about making good architectural solutions to the wrong questions. And I jumped ship, and I ended up going, I trained at the Bartlett, and then I ended up going to the LSE, and I did the first year of Ricky Burdett's Cities Design sort of like masters there, which was absolutely transformative. And it really made me realize how fortunate I'd been to go through the Bartlett in the middle 80s when I did, when it was very much, it was studying about how to understand cities and people and problem solving. And from doing sort of like city design, I became an urban designer. I got very interested in housing. Dickon Robinson from the Peabody Trust, who at the time, amazing client for sort of like architecture, Came along and talked about the work and the architecture that he was building and the homes that he was sort of building. And I went, oh, I want to work for you. I want to work for you. So I went to work for a housing association, and he sort of said, well, what can you do? I said, oh, I can do anything really, you know, just ask me. And he said, well, have you done any research? So I said, yes, of course I've done research, you know, all architects can do research. So I became a built environment researcher. And after a few years from there, I moved to government Quango, which was the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment. And I ran their research programme for about 9 years, which was phenomenal. Because here we were, sort of like, you know, there were maybe about 90 of us, and we were sitting there telling governments how they should be spending their money, how they should be building their schools, how they should be making theatres. How it was absolutely quite remarkable, until we got shut down by somebody whose name I won't mention, but then we'll go. So at that point, I think Loretta and I met when I was at Peabody. You were supervising, I was industry supervisor, wasn't I?
Yes, we first met at Peabody, because I'd approached Peabody to see if they were interested in doing what at the time were known as ODPM ESRC studentships, where the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister under Blair had teamed up with the ESRC to fund, you know, very kind of applied PhD studentships. And that's where we first met. It was a long time ago.
So when in the bonfire of the Quangos I lost my job, I decided I was going to do a PhD, and you know, ended up contacting Loretta, and we'll talk about when we talk about the book and defensible space, sort of like actually how impactful sort of like it was. And having done my PhD, I now currently I head up the research and strategy team at Clarion Housing, which is currently the largest housing association in England. And it's quite a remarkable job, but it's been really, really good.
That's a wonderful story. So, Loretta, as you said, your background, well, when I first came across your writing, it was in relation to your work on gentrification. And you have been, I think, probably for the last 20 years, the main writer around gentrification in the Western Hemisphere. You know, there's a huge amount of your writing out there, and I've been reading it recently actually, because I've been looking at gentrification in Margate, where I am currently situated, which is going through the process at, you know, breakneck speed. How do you get from, as an introduction into the book, how do you get from gentrification to defensibility?
Well, it's really interesting because it kind of came through two prongs. So if you take me back to what I was like age 17, so I'd moved to Belfast in Northern Ireland because my parents had separated and ended up in school there. Originally, I was brought up in Manchester, and I was doing A-level geography. And as part of the project for that A-level geography, I looked at defensible space in the tower block flats in the New Lodge, which was this kind of Catholic ghetto area of North Belfast. And of course, because I had an English accent, I was unable to actually physically go into them. So I remember buying boxes of chocolates for classmates who actually lived in them, so they would interview their kind of neighbours, etc., about defensible space and what they thought about it. And the reason I got into defensible space in that was because I was also doing A-level history of art. And they had a whole section in that on modern design and modern architecture, which looked at high-rise living. So really, I've been kind of obsessed with this since the 70s. Kind of, you know, 17-year-old. But then if I think back, when I was about seven, my grandfather's uncle had moved into new blocks of flats in Salford, which were kind of which had replaced the kind of classic Salford slum in Pendleton. And I remember as a seven-year-old going up to the top floor of that flat to meet my granddad's brother and just being overwhelmed by the design of the building, the smell of urine in the kind of corridors, and just the kind of the whole scene of what was, you know, coming out of a kind of three bed house, coming into this kind of block of flats, and, you know, the kind of people who were living in them and how they seemed quite down at heel at the time. Lots of older people were quite disappointed and felt very trapped in them. So I think it had kind of come from that obsession and interest in high-rise living and kind of blocks of flats. But then it came again when I got involved through gentrification, actually. So I got involved over the last I guess, 10, 15 years, helping activists in London fight the demolition of big council estates in London, like the Haygate estate, the Aylesbury estate. And of course, defensible space was one of the premises that were put forward as to why they should be demolished, because they didn't have good defensible space, and therefore they were crime ridden and, you know, attracted deviance and antisocial behaviour and stuff like that. So really, this kind of long term interest from a 7-year-old, a 17-year-old, right the way up to, you know, kind of that work I was doing with activists on London, plus then, you know, having a wonderful PhD student, Eleanor, plus having actually met Alice Coleman when I started my very first job at King's, all which I can talk about later, all kind of came together. So that's how I got into it.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'd love, we must talk more about Alice Coleman. But this book, why this book now? Why have you decided to turn your attention to this? Is this in response to the sort of, I suppose, there was that moment where high-rise housing, and I'm reading defensibility as an issue here, directly related to high-rise housing, and perhaps I'm wrong in that, you can set me right, but also that it started to come back, like particularly in urban centres where we've now got this remarkable boom of high-rise living, which I assume 10 years from now will have the same stories being told about it.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is about the... Shall I just answer this, Ellen, and then you jump in, or do you want to go first?
Well, I was going to go first because I think two points about it. One, you've made exactly the right connection that it's not necessarily, though, about the height of the building, but it's about the number of people who are there. So, and I think we'll come back to that time and time again. It's about levels of occupancy, numbers of sort of like occupancy, how many people sort of like are all coming together. But I was going to jump in as well with this, because actually defensible space as well as a concept has followed me throughout my career. And I think it's one of the things which has had this whole sort of like length of time behind it. And I've felt quite often I've had a sense of deja vu about it. So when I started out as a architecture student at the Bartlett in the 1980s, Bill Hillier, you know, Space Syntax Bill Hillier, I remember sitting in his lectures, and you know, he was a fearsome critic of Alice Coleman and a fearsome critic of Utopia on Tile. It was exactly that time when she just published her first sort of like book, and I remember sitting there in a lecture and looking at all these sort of like slides of estates and things that they were sort of like changing. And that was about, I think, one of the first times that it really occurred to me that, you know, architectural designs, however well intentioned, could do huge amounts of harm, that we have this enormous responsibility. And then again, when I was at CABE, we were doing a project for the Home Office, and we were looking at crime levels in award-winning high-density housing schemes. So again, it was that high-density, so like lots of people living together. And we were looking at things like the parking areas and the courts and the corridors and the stairwells and those odd corners of wasted space. And that's where all the problems were found. And I think William Yancey, who's the guy who first coined the term sort of like defensible space, he described these as wasted space, not because nothing happened there. That's where all the antisocial behaviour was sort of like located, but more because they were wasted because they squandered the opportunities to encourage the encounters that shaped sort of like social networks and encounter and all those sort of things. And at CABE, we spent so much of our time saying, how do you design for positive encounter? How do we? And yet this is where we were finding where the crime was. And I felt this huge sense of deja vu. You know, hadn't Alice Coleman sort of like talked about this, you know, 20 years ago? Why were we making these same sort of like mistakes? Why were we repeating these sort of like problems in housings we were building now? And I think that was one of the things that really prompted Loretta and I to write the book. Exactly that sort of like sense of feeling of, we should know how to design better than this. What are we doing making these sort of like same mistakes again?
But I think off the back of that, it was also about, there was almost like a repoliticization of high-rise living, you know, so there was suddenly the proliferation in London and New York and Dubai and Singapore of high-rise living, you know, and it's like the model of how to do inner city kind of regeneration. Yet at the same time, there was this kind of continuing undermining and stigmatization of high-rise public housing blocks. And then, of course, the kind of new urban renewal that began to be practiced under Tony Blair's government was a copy of what had been going on in the United States under the HOPE 6 programme, where the Federal Housing and Urban Development Authority began to demolish big blocks of public housing projects and redevelop them as mixed income new build housing, which usually led to gentrification and usually led to wholesale displacement. So I think it was interesting to go back and look at the way it was politicised in the 70s and 80s to compare the way it's been repoliticized through the 90s. And then again, of course, when David Cameron got in, you know, again, he had this kind of mantra about, you know, the problematic council estate full of, you know, kind of drug users and deviant people that really played off of many of these earlier stereotypes. So I think it was a real kind of coming together and a really good time for both of us for a whole host of wide but different reasons to kind of do this. So I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of cool, Loretta.
Sound like a hipster.
When I started reading your book, I realized in the tutorials I had been giving the week before in the master's program that I coordinate at Kent, that I had been talking about defensible space, but I hadn't realized, I suppose, that that's what I was talking about. It had become It's become so embedded within it, but perhaps it might be useful to kind of define the terms. I mean, the origin story that you track in the book is very interesting through from Oscar Newman and through across the pond to Britain. But perhaps if we could start by defining what we mean, what is meant by defensible space, and perhaps from the perspective of a geographer and an architect, because I'm really interested. I didn't realize, for example, that defensibility or defensible space was a concept that was common parlance in the wider geography world. I thought it was just something that people talked about in architecture. It was another one of these kind of bits of language that we use that no one else uses and no one else understands. So what does it mean from both sides of this? Or is it the same thing?
Do you want to do the architecture definition, Eleanor, and then I'll try geography?
Yeah, I think so. So defensible space is really that way that we can shape and make spaces, particularly around homes, to sort of really affect residents' feelings of ownership and territoriality. And we can do that by increasing the permeability of the space, or sort of like the surveillance, or even more clearly delineating that transition between public and private spaces. And I've realized that I've automatically fallen into that architect speak of, you know, delineation of sort of like spaces between private and public. But I think territoriality, and I think territoriality is something which, you know, geographers and historians, everybody sort of like talks about. But there were lots of other things which Newman really picked up, and Newman was an architect, which are all things about like the image of a place, how the materiality, how it looks, how it feels, whether an estate is seen as different and unique or different and isolated is really important. So that appearance of place really impacts on defensible space. There's all the stuff that goes on around it. Maybe that's quite sort of like geographer, but there's also something about the way that space flows and moves, and actually the reading of the symbolism of spaces. You know, is this my space? Is this your space? Who should be there? So I think a lot of those are really, you know, they're very architectural ideas. What I really like about Oscar Newman was that he was able to be very clear about that definition, about how you moved from public space through semi-public space to semi-private space to sort of private space, and defined all the different spaces from sort of like, you know, front yards to walking up sort of like staircases to sort of like lift lobbies to inside lobbies, all those spaces that we need to sort of design. And Alice Coleman added some ideas to that, like confused space, that space wasn't clear, that it was a bit sort of like ambiguous and stuff. So I think a lot of the architectural ideas around defensible space come from this idea that we can design these spaces which contain activities. Whereas I think maybe geographer, they are interested in the activities and see how they impact on the spaces that they surround.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I think in many ways it was the sociologists who were more interested in the activities than the geographers. And I think different disciplines have really kind of attached themselves to defensible space in a different way. So in the book, we talk about criminologists, we talk about geographers, and we talk about architects. But actually, you can broaden that out because much of the earlier work, like the pre-Oscar Newman work by Yancey, for example, who was a sociologist, who many claim actually was the person who came up with the coining of the term defensible space. But I think for geographers, one of the big attractions of this is that geography is a spatial science, and that, defensible space is, it's a spatial concept. And actually, we talk about it as a spatial concept at the beginning of the book. And then Eleanor's talked about some of the kind of differentiations within of this between public space, private space, semi-public, semi-private, confused space. What does that mean? And certainly in geography in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a growth of work on territoriality in the city, work on, for example, graffiti, mapping graffiti, a real interesting kind of mapping how people territorialize space through either, kind of tagging it with graffiti or through certain behaviors in that space, which then drew on sociology. And, there was just this kind of real interest that. Also that, kind of work that was arguing that, like Alice Coleman, that high rises lack defensible space was environmentally determined, and that her argument was very much something that geographers didn't do anymore. We didn't do environmental determinism. We didn't argue anymore that the environment determines behavior, that was too simplistic. Yet here we had a whole kind of new body of work that was arguing that if you redeveloped these high rises or knocked them down and replaced them with low rises, that the new structure of that built environment would determine better behavior because defensible space was built into it. So lots of different reasons, I think, that geography kind of attached themselves to this.
It's very interesting because I think when people like me hear it and have heard it previously, the assumption has been sort of it doesn't sort of make any sense. Defense is about stopping people attacking you, and it's a more subtle concept than that, as you've both I think explained, and and comes back to this word that you've used a number of times, territoriality, which I would like to understand a little bit better. What do people mean when they talk about territoriality? Is this what I suppose might be called sense of place, place making? Is that territoriality addressing place? I mean,
I think place is very important. Loretta and I, during lockdown, wrote a paper,
oh, yes.
which was, it grew out of the mad lockdown walks that we sort of, everybody took, and the way that you got very bored with where you're walking, you started to sort of like explore your way sort of through different estates and start to watch and see what was going on. And what we saw in those walks was that people were beginning to use spaces, and particularly spaces around their homes, very differently. They were starting to inhabit them very differently. They were starting to redefine territoriality. And one of the ways that that was really happening was you would see objects outside. You'd see a book left outside. You'd see a chair left outside. You'd see sort of like bits of stuff, people with their laptop, all the things which were there. And, all my life as an architect working on estates, if you see a sofa, it always used to be you see a sofa on an estate, then it's a trashy estate. Something's gone really, really wrong. And there was something about a change in territoriality, which was about ownership, which was about this is my space. And as I was doing the PhD, I spent a lot of time talking to secure by design officers. And one of them had this lovely thing. He used to say, well, it's a flower pot test. If you can walk along an access deck and somebody's got flower pots and they're actually there and they've got their sort of like doormat and it's there and things are hung up and there's a seat out there, then this feels, maybe you're right. Maybe this feels like it's my place. This is a place which, I can actually live in, and this is somewhere where I can actually be. So I think it's less about place making in that way that we think in the urban design, how do things sort of fit together, but But really, that sort of like sense of I have the right to be here, and I can make this place, I can make this sort of space do what I need it to be, so I can sort of like, get on with my life with this.
I mean, I think some of it is maybe about sense of community as well. So, I mean, one of the main things they talked about in moving people from, terraced housing, working class terraced housing, which was slum cleared into these high rise blocks, was the breakdown of community. And they kind of hark back to, the kind of front door, the doorstep that people were kind of, scrubbing with their limestone, whatever it was they used to scrub their doorstep with. But it gave them a sense of ownership of their home, and that the street in front of it was a very public space where children were playing outside, but they were able to kind of control that territory in front of them, that public space, by sitting there talking to their neighbours, keeping an eye on their children, maybe their neighbours doing that. And it kind of harkens back to the whole Jane Jacobs work on Eyes on the Street, where these kind of communities came together to protect each other. So if you can talk about it as territoriality in that way. And part of the argument was this was all broken down when that kind of built environment was destroyed in the construction of Streets in the Sky, which were seen to be completely different built environments.
You've mentioned Jacobs and you mentioned Yancey as well. I mean, what is the chronology of this idea? I mean, is this a specifically 20th century or late 20th, second half of the 20th century idea, or are there stirrings of this anxiety around a lack of defensibility, a lack of territorial ownership in earlier analysis of the city and of specifically of mass housing for particularly underprivileged and less economically advantaged people.
I can probably jump in there because I've actually dragged out the one best Jane Jacobs quote, which really covers it. And she did very much pick up on within this idea of active street life and social interactions. And she actually noted that there were more crimes in the sort of accessible but deserted public spaces around housing estates. She really sort of like picked that up rather than conventionally crowded streets. So she'd really noticed. And as Loretta was saying, sort of, Jacobs was probably the first to really clearly articulate that different taxonomy of spaces. So, and the really famous quote, she talks about these three different types of space, and she goes, first, there must be a clear demarcation between what is public space and what is private space. I've been really clear about this. Public and private spaces cannot ooze into each other as they do in typically suburban settings or in projects. Second, there must be eyes on the street, eyes belonging to those we might call the natural proprietors of the street. The buildings on a street equipped to handle strangers and to ensure the safety of both residents and strangers must be orientated on the street. So again, that's like, residents, the people you're familiar with, but equally other people who might be finding their way through it. And then she says, and third, the sidewalk must have users in fairly continuous, both to add to the number of effective eyes on the street and to induce people in buildings along the street to watch the sidewalks in sufficient numbers. So you can see all of the things she's talking about are definitions, clarity, having people, having enough people there to sort of like actually watch, to entice you to look out, to give that natural surveillance, to feel engaged with the place. And I think a lot of the things about defensible space are, it's not about shutting yourself away, it's about engaging and engaging with others, engaging with the activity, and feeling that you have a right, feeling you have a right to say, this is, I don't want, the antisocial behavior to be happening in a space that I think is mine.
I mean, going back, Ambrose, to your comment about the genealogy of the term, I think it's really interesting. So in the book, we're very clear that it's not fixed, that, for example, and it's a bit like with the term gentrification, gentrification existed before the term was coined. In a way, defensible space existed before the concept, come term, whatever you want to call it, was coined. If you go back to like looking at the kind of rookeries in the 1800s, there's kind of reference to similar kind of stuff in relation to that. But I think what's really interesting about this one is how the term gets activated through different disciplines. So one thing we're really interested in the book is the kind of genealogy and history of how it goes through and moves forward in sociology versus geography versus architecture, urban planning and criminology. And it kind of does in parallel. And what's really interesting in the book, and we kind of pull this out, is how each kind of discipline uses its own authority to kind of trash other definitions in other disciplines of it, which it sometimes is actually quite hilarious in the book and really quite cutting. You know, it's like, oh, that's just sociology. Sociology's nonsense, or, you know, something like that. So actually, you know, trying to trace the genealogy of these terms is incredibly difficult. And that's why this whole, all this work on policy mobilities is tricky, because it kind of attaches itself to, or at least we're attaching it to the point of this concept. But, you know, it goes way back in history and it's continuing to move forwards today. It's not a static entity.
Yeah. This phrase you've used, you talked of it as activated through different disciplines. And that was a point I was very interested in, of thinking about how a geographer and an architect produce work together. Because I think the discipline of architecture has a tendency towards looking inwards. And so it's a very interesting kind of way of analysing architecture, I think. And I would love to hear about what you feel both sides.
Ellen is an incredibly outward architect, outward-looking architect, who's really an urbanist.
Okay.
Thank you.
But I like this phrase you use, activated through different disciplines, and you've used the phrase policy mobilities. And obviously that, you know, the subtitle of the book, Defensible Space on the Move, mobilization in English housing policy and practice. I would like to understand that a little bit better. Like, what are we talking about? The story of the book obviously documents this transformation of an essentially American concept in a British context through policy, through people, and through two other things that you talk about. You talk about assemblages, and you talk about boundary objects. I would kind of like to understand this a little bit better. It's a confusing question. I specialize in confusing question. It's my USP. But what are we talking about in terms of this subtitle, this mobilization?
Do you want to take it from an architect's perspective, Eleanor?
I will. So I love... This is what I love about geography, is they are very good at articulating things that as designers you sort of, you know, you do take for granted in some way. So assemblage, this sort of like whole process of understanding the powerful interactions of things and people, of actions, of how actually, you know, a place or a space might have the potential for something, but it's not until that activity happens within it. And so I think that sense of assemblage being, you know, the physical and the something else which is needed, and that something else might be a policy, that might be an idea, that might be a desire to sort of reduce the crime in an area, that could be a concept, but it sort of needs to work together with the stuff and the thingness that is sort of like there, and so that actually was really very, very sort of like powerful. And I guess the reason we were interested in that sense of policy, and this is why I did my PhD as a geographer rather than as an architect, was because I don't think we get to talk enough about the different mechanisms that we have under our control to change things, to make decisions about how places either should come about or they should sort of like actually function. And I don't think we think hard enough about the way we do see the world differently, even though, you know, the housing estates that we're talking about are the territories where all sorts of different things get played out. So when I started to do the PhD, I thought I was going to do a PhD which would be a very classic CABE, Commission for Architecture and Built Environment piece of research, and it would have some guidelines and design processes and bits of stuff there. And actually it became It became much more about how academics and how practitioners, how sort of planners and housing managers and designers and people who actually do things think differently from, say, policymakers about an idea. And that actually what we have to do is we have to find ways of having assemblages which allow all these different disciplines to do their bit. Because if we neglect it, then we either get you know, very abstract theories, or we get policies which sort of like fall apart when you try and sort of like apply them in a new place, in a duplicated place, or else we get practitioners, you know, the sort of people I work with on a day-to-day sort of like level, who are trying to do things, and they just see, they're just sort of seeing the world in a slightly different way.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And you talk about assemblages as fragile. You call them fragile ideas because they are, I guess, relational, and relationships are mobile
Absolutely.
And fluid and hybrid and very, well, they, you know, they're fragile. And yet defensibility has remained such a robust idea within that. Is that because that at the heart of an effective assemblage, essentially, there is an assembly of there is a core concept that is very easily grasped?
Yes. And I think this is the thing about defensible space. We describe it as this sort of cluster of ideas, this cluster of pieces which sort of like come together, and they reformulate themselves in different ways. And we used to say, oh my goodness, you know, defensible space, it's becoming almost more baroque. You can sort of like, it's like a set of stickle bricks that you can put together in lots of different ways. But you look at it and you go, oh, here's a chunk of stuff which is put together. And I think there's something about defensible space that is so immediately graspable. You know, from the residents I talked to your granny about it, to just academics, there is something, you've really hit on it, that there is something at its core which you recognise and people actually respond to sort of really strongly. I think the struggle, I think this is why the book feels really useful, is because we don't really quite understand how it works. I don't think that completely matters. I think it's more that we have lots of different explanations about how it might work. And I think what's really important is we have to explain that clearly enough that the people who actually have to deal with it, you know, the architects and designers and planners, are able to say, okay, this is what we're going to try and do. This is what we're going to try and do here in this place now.
And interestingly,
and that's good enough.
If two different people had written the book, how it came together would have been different. So the assemblage of the book itself probably would have told quite a different story of defensible space. So I don't think there's ever a kind of definitive answer to what these assemblages may ever be. But I think one thing that's really important about the book is that we adopt an assemblage approach. And what that does is it makes the book very, very empirical. And we even say in the introduction that we are unapologetically empirical in this book. You know, and this is in a world in urban studies and urban geography where theory is king. Unless you're theorizing, you know, doing empirics and doing detailed, rich empirical work, archival work just doesn't have the same purchase. But actually we demonstrate in this book how it does and how it's really important. If you want to pull apart these different inputs to these assemblages in a particular place at a moment in time, you can only do that by doing a deep dive empirically. And, you know, that's what we try to do. But recognizing that even what we've managed to pull together in this book is not exhaustive. There will be lots of other stuff that's gone on. And indeed, we touched on that. I thought, right, we can't go there. That's too much. The book will be too long. It would take us another 10 years. You know, so I guess one of the problems with assemblage kind of approaches and theories is, you know, like, when do you stop and kind of, you know, when do you define your parameters for the book,
for example? It is a very interesting idea. And I mean, you talk about the fertile ground that it's come into. And I think you've talked about, you know, you've touched on that already, this idea of the problem of the housing estate itself, the modernist housing estate specifically. In fact, and I think this is really interesting, the fact that defensibility seems to speak more to the virtues of the demolished inner city slums in places like Glasgow, Liverpool, Manchester, and the East End of London. And so for me, it's interesting, and I think this leads on to Alice Coleman and perhaps Bill Hillier's antipathy towards her as a character, is that it seems to smack to a certain degree of a conservative perspective, in that it seems to be a little bit about the past and trying to rebuild social capital and social networks that were possible through
Yeah,
those
I mean,
things.
it's kind of one of the reasons that Create Streets has really kind of become slightly obsessed with Alice Coleman and the return to that kind of traditional view of British housing. You know, and it's a very kind of conservative, traditional, classic notion of what we should be living in as a British population. And, you know, it's debatable. And, you know, really, the story in the book is very much about here we had this geographer, Alice Coleman, who was very conservative in her views, very kind of, you know, connected ultimately to the Conservative Party, particularly to Margaret Thatcher, at a time in the 80s and 90s when British geography was Marxist geography dominated, very, very left wing, not even liberal, very left wing. So she was doing something very radical and different at that time that just did not fit. So the politics played in this, the kind of conservative and non-conservative in very complex ways, I think, through the story.
Eleanor.
And she was, I mean, it was one of the things about Alice which was contradictory. We described her as a Marmite personality. People either really got her or, you know, we described her also as grit in the oyster. You know, she was somebody that people sort of like pushed against. There was this whole conference called Rehumanizing Housing, which was, you know, such a collection of every sort of like really left-thinking, fabulous sort of like community architect who was sort of like coming together. It was a whole day, which was basically pulling apart Alice Coleman and you know the deterministic, the very, very much sort of like conservative view. And one of the people at the sort of like conference said, actually, in some ways, we were really grateful for Alice because, you know, we had this huge concern about, you know, the rise of the new right. If Alice hadn't existed, we would have had to invent her because she acted as this coalescing point for all, you know, all of these left-wing academics who, you know, I think were doing some really impressive work. So she is quite a difficult character, but it enabled. There was something about her persistence, and this is why we keep sort of describing it, being her as an anti-guru, as a you know as the grit in the oyster, that she the provoking she provoked people to think really hard about their position. You had to sort of like be clear and sort of like decisive about it. And I think there are some people who their role is to sort of, you know, get other people to be really, really clear about what their position is.
And because she was very confident and quite dogmatic in her views around this, you know, she was able to do that because she, you know, never wavered that she believed in this.
And
You know, my
to have,
data tells this story. I have proof here. So she was obsessed with evidence and proof. And, you know, anybody who does social science, having proof and having evidence is 99% of the way there in terms of feeding through to public policy. But here we have a really weird story of actually quite unproven and contradictory social science that feeds through to public policy.
Because she had the confidence. She had the confidence to go to talk to, you know, the head of the Met and say, you need to be training up sort of like police officers so they can understand the design of housing estates, so they know where there's going to be crime. That's what led to sort of like, you know, Secure by Design and all of the process there. But Alice was the sort of person who'd say, come in, I'll show you some sort of like diagrams. Come in, this is what you need to be doing. There was something quite headmistressy about her, I think.
Yeah, and she pushed against closed doors. You know, she pushed against the doors at Downing Street until she finally got in, and she was not going to give up. So fair play to the woman. You know, it takes tremendous confidence and stamina to do that, and particularly as a female, you know, geography professor at that stage.
I think, I mean, Jane Jacobs likewise took a bit of a beating as well for her temerity of standing up in the face of ideological modernism, in the application of ideological modernism to city landscapes. And I want to come on to that just in a second, this idea of what this what you call middle ground theory, because I think it's really fascinating. I really fascinating idea. But there was a lot of people at that time at the and you know from the mid 60s onwards. I'm thinking there was a woman up in in governing Glasgow called Annie Gibbons, who was just a resident in a tenement block whose block was going to be demolished to make way for progress, and working with the architect's assist under Raymond Young, who was just an undergraduate student at Strathclyde, I think, at the time. They worked out how to fix her loo. There's a book called Annie's Loo on it. But there was Pearl Jeffcott. She got thrown under the bus for being for questioning this thing. And I always remember, because I lived up in Glasgow before we moved down south, there was a phrase they used to say in Scotland, which was, "Yeah, canny through a geely piece, a 20-story tour," which means you can't throw a jam sandwich out of a tall building. But it is that idea, isn't it? That's again that territoriality. There's this idea of defensibility. A mother couldn't look out the window and see her kiddies.
Absolutely.
And I think that her gender probably played a significant, Alice Coleman's gender played a significant role in her.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, we're very clear. We're kind of very clear that there's lots of kind of histories written about geographers. You know, there were very few written about female geographers, mainly because there weren't many female geographers up until, I guess, the late 1980s onwards. So we talk about her story, but that her story is also a story about myself and Eleanor writing the book as two women. It's also about the other female characters, like Sheena, like Anne Power, who becomes the kind of foil, and Sheena, who's kind of one of the kind of housing women who in many ways kind of introduces defensible space, possibly slightly earlier than Alice Coleman, but it's taken on board in a different way and rejected in a different way. So I think the gender dynamics are actually really complex.
And I think you're right, because we got very interested in what was happening, say, in research in housing and the Department of the Environment. And at the time, there was Judith Lockwood, who was an amazing researcher. And Sheena Wilson, who Loretta mentioned, very early on, she'd gone out and met Oscar Newman in the States and had come back and said, "Oh my goodness, I think this is going to be a really useful idea." And had moved from the Home Office, where she was working on crime, to the Department of Environment, because she thought this is where it would be able to make a difference. And it got dismissed as, "Oh, this is all about child density and a bit of vandalism." And it's just because children just sort of play and they can't tell whether, you know. And if you read the AJ and sort of like all the way that it's her work's described, and she's, you know, Sheena Wilson was a really solid researcher, really solid. And the AJ has pictures of kids jumping in, you know, knocking flowers over as if it's a little bit of gratuity. And there was something, and I think this is one of the things that Alice Coleman bringing this idea from the States was, that there was this sort of perception that, oh, in America there's huge problems, they have enormous problems with their projects, and it's just terrible, it's absolutely awful. Oh, but we just have a little bit of, you know, a little bit of vandalism. It's children, and
it's not shooting or kind of, you know, murder
exactly,
on the streets.
Exactly. It was really sort of like playing down the impact, you know, that was happening to people's lives. And that's why I think, I mean, it was really nice to hear you mention, you know, a woman resident who was the prompt for a lot of activity. We talk a lot about the Mozart, exactly, the Mozart estate. And Muriel Agnew there was exactly the same character. Mm-hmm. She was somebody who'd moved to the sort of like estate when it was all new and shiny, and then sort of like 10 years later when everything started to sort of fall apart, she was the one who was knocking on doors and saying, "We have to do something about this. We have to sort of like change it." And I think there's something about having to recognize how it's probably as much about, It is about gender, but it's about power. It's about who has the right to sort of really engage and sort of say, this is how we want things to be. Things have to improve.
Yeah.
And I think what's also interesting is kind of Oscar Newman, I think, was quite conscious of this gender dimension playing on around him. Because I remember he kind of quoted something about getting out under the skirts of Jane Jacobs. Mm. You know, he wanted to be seen as his own person, separate from Jane Jacobs and doing different things. So, you know, that, you know, Jane Jacobs herself, but then subsequent women who came to meet him in New York were obviously a bit of a threat to his kind of masculine identity around defensible space in a weird way.
And he was amazing. He was such a showman. I mean, Sheena Wilson said, you know, he had the brand, he had the showmanship, he was, you know, it had everything going for it. And again, you know, you asked about boundary objects and people. Sometimes ideas get so tied up with individuals, don't they? And the way they are and the way they present themselves, it's quite hard sometimes to step back and really assess, you know, the value which is there.
And academics like to own ideas or feel they own ideas because, of course, it's connected to their career trajectory, their reputation. So they don't like it when somebody else comes along and either tries to do what they're doing or refutes what they're doing. Mm. So it's quite a protective kind of thing as well.
And it's one of the things, you know, I mentioned, you know, this memory I had of this fearsome critique of Bill Hillier ripping Alice Coleman's work apart, and it happened with other sort of like criminologists as well, and savagely that academic debate, which was absolutely brutal. And then talking to him afterwards, and he said, "Oh, we got, you know, we made up. It was fine. You know, Alice knew a bit about the outside, and I knew about the streets, and you know what, we sort of made it up together." And there was something about that really being able to sort of. It comes back to this idea of a fragile idea or a tough idea, and how hard you lay into it. We'll see if it's resilient or not.
But I think she was also incredibly resilient. So I remember when I very first met her, I moved to King's College London into the geography department in 1997, I think it was. And she was then an emeritus professor. So she used to come in once a week to pick up her mail. And I remember people in the department who'd worked with her for a long time telling me, "Oh, you don't want to meet her." She was obviously seen as this embarrassing, separate academic, even though she had become a full professor just before she retired. And in fact, the fact she wasn't made a full professor until just before she retired was a kind of real sense of annoyance for her. And, you know, it was definitely down to gender. And, you know, if you go back into the 70s, right up until the 80s, you know, at King's College London, the dining room was only accepting men and not women. So female staff had to eat somewhere else, you know, and that wasn't that long before I started, you know, and you forget what was going on in terms of women being in academia then. So she was incredibly resilient on a whole host of different fronts, you know, so fair play to her, you know, an impressive woman overall.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. But the success of defensibility, this movement of this policy idea from the States, from Coleman and through Sheena Wilson and Alice Coleman and various others, this isn't only because of their determination to enact it and their connections and their determination to forge those connections and even the media. I mean, you talk quite interestingly about Oscar Newman coming over here and doing a TV show to kind of talk about this, and sort of I sort of read it as sort of hoping to see some of the dereliction and despair that he had seen in America replicated here. But it's also this idea that you touch on, which you call the defensibility is a kind of middle range theory. And I wondered, as a sort of academic interest, I was quite interested in this idea. You know, obviously modernism has a very high end, high range theory, you know, it's a totalizing vision. And then you've got the opposite end of the spectrum, which is, I guess you can explain, but middle range, what do we mean by this?
You want to start, Eleanor, and I'll chip. Do you want me to chip?
Yes, of course. So middle range theory, and as a practitioner, as somebody who started out as an architect, it's deeply sort of like attractive, because there's this sense of how you make things work, how you sort of like fit things together, how you can have a series of sort of like half ideas and theories which sort of sit together, but you have to work out how they work in a particular context. So it's very much about making sure that something fits within a place and a context and a time, and it feels like it's something that architects and designers and planners, all sorts of people, do very naturally. There's something about theory building as a middle range theory, which is about how we make sense of the world in in quite a provisional way. It's like, how is it working now in this place? How does it fit together? Which I think felt really attractive. And that's where it's easy to be quite critical of the way that, say, Alice Coleman presented Defensible Space, because she wanted it to be a perfect theory. She said, you know, if you act in this way, this is how things would work. And that's not really quite how the world was, or how the world is and how it sort of like acts. And I think middle range theories allow for that sort of like provisionality. They allow for that sort of like sense of trying to work out how things are at the moment and might be and might sort of like fit together. That's why it fits so well with this sense of assemblage. It's like, here are the pieces we've got and how do they sort of fit together.
I think one of the words we use in the book is malleability. So we talk about, it's almost like, you know, it's so malleable that depending on which context, which temporality it plays out in, it can be kind of molded into what's going on. But it's also middle range because it's neither proven or disproven. You know, it's very difficult to do either. You know, there are people on both sides, but actually in reality, it's almost impossible to prove or disprove Defensible Space. And that in itself is really interesting, and that gives it a mobility and malleability that other concepts don't have, and that can be used in different places in different ways.
It seems to parallel to me a lot of the discussions in postmodern theory, and obviously this does correlate with, you know, this is obviously a postmodern, if geography has postmodernity as a theoretical positioning, then this seems to be something to do with it. This idea of the everyday, of taking something that is a totalizing vision, Defensible Space, I don't know, high-rise housing for everybody, applying it to a context and allowing the context in a way to mediate and curate that theory, and then seeing what pops out the other end. Is that kind of what you're doing? You know,
I think assemblage theory is a little bit more complex than that. It's about how things, actors, actants, whatever, come together in a place, how they're held in place, how they work together, but also how they work differently. But most importantly, it's really about how they kind of open or close down possibilities. And I think, again, that's where this kind of middle range theory idea connects, because Defensible Space can either, you know, kind of close down or open up possibilities, depending on which way it's angled. So I think that, I mean, an assemblage approach is quite difficult. So, I mean, it's one that's become very dominant in geography. And it's really about trying to connect everything that comes together to create a situation or a moment or a whatever. But as you can imagine, that's incredibly difficult because, you know, moments pass very quickly. So actually, you know, something that happened 5 minutes before could be radically different in terms of assemblage to something that happens 5 minutes later. So you have to kind of set that insanity to one side and do what we've done, an attempt to kind of bring together what we think are the most important components of this assemblage at different points in time, right through the 70s, 80s, into the 90s and up into the current day.
And the other thing that we found really helpful was this sort of sense of different types of knowledge, and not just different types of knowledge from different disciplines, but thinking about, you know, the real fundamentals. So picking up on the basic things about, you have episteme, and I can never say this the right way, which episteme. Is that real, exactly, that real pure theory knowledge, which is just really sort of the right thing. Then sort of like techne, that sort of, this is the bit which is how things sort of like work and the rules and the sort of physics sort of stuff there. And then the bit that was really appealing, which is this phronesis, which is the knowledge of how to act. What should I be doing in this circumstance, at this point, in this location? And that's what it feels that practice does. That's what it feels that practice is good at balancing, about going from saying, here's this vision, here's this big, big theory, big sort of like idea, there's some technical stuff, but actually, how do we make that decision about how to act? And that was really, really helpful. And it was really helpful to look at all of the different people, you know, from Muriel Agnew to sort of like Ann Power to all the way through to the politicians who were deciding things, and thinking where were they sitting? Where were they sitting in that sort of like triangle? How were they seeing the world? How were they valuing that knowledge that they knew? What value did they give to the evidence? What value did they give to the research? What value did they give to how that knowledge was used?
And it's interesting, you know, if you look at the Centrefold, which is a kind of case study of the Mozart estate in London, and looking at how defensible space was put into practice in the redevelopment of that estate, you know, even that is not proven or disproven. It's not clear whether it's been successful or not. And in fact, myself and Eleanor, was it last summer? When was it, Eleanor? We went walking around.
Oh, God, yeah. No, it was this summer. It was this summer. It was about May.
Recent summer. You know, we're walking around, and even ourselves, we're like walking around going, okay, that's defense. They've built that bit. That's defensible space practice there. That isn't. And it was a confused melee of mixed ideas around defensible space. It wasn't quite clear whether it worked or not. It was just quite strange, to be honest.
Yeah.
How do we take this forward in terms of where do you see defensible space as a concept? I mean, obviously, as you've pointed out, Eleanor, you've used the phrase secured by design. We have that in policy, but where does it go now? Is it here to stay within housing development policy, urban development policy? Is it on the move again? Is it being inflected by new ideas?
I think it had a real moment, probably a sort of like about 5 or 10 years ago, and it was, you know, in the London plan and every sort of like policy, and everybody had lots of words where it's been very, very explicitly sort of like spoken about. And because I work in the housing association sector, I have a stack of various sort of like design guides that different, you know, all the employers' requirements, and actually it started to drop out. People don't, I mean, they mention defensibility, and certainly when I'm having day-to-day comments, you know, we're doing some work looking at deck access now, and of course it'll be defensible. And everybody says, of course. And that's the thing about it. And I'm forever saying, yes, but what do you actually mean about it?
Mm.
Because I do think, and it isn't just the reflection from the lockdown and the paper and the thinking that Loretta and I did during sort of like lockdown. I think we are going through one of those moments of change, inflection about how people use space, that expectation for the spaces, particularly the spaces around our homes. So I think it's really important now, not in some ways, I think it's quite a good thing that defensible space doesn't have the same policy sort of like, you know, seriousness that it had in every local authority sort of like plan, because we should be thinking again, does it mean the same that it meant when, you know, even sort of like 10 to 15 years ago? Because I think we've seen so many things sort of changing during the pandemic, and I think one of the things which has been this revalorizing, re sort of thinking how we use spaces, how we renegotiate that social remaking spaces becomes really clear.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it kind of ebbs and flows. So I think in the US context, I mean, it's quite different. So there's still this kind of obsession with kind of new urbanism here. Mm. So most of the new build developments here are still kind of built around new urbanist principles, and new urbanist principles have defensible space principles inbuilt into them in terms of, you know, creating these kind of gated communities that have defensible space around their homes, etc., etc. And that hasn't disappeared in the kind of private redevelopment sector. Whereas I think a little bit like in the UK on the public housing front, I think the federal department of HUD here has begun to kind of backtrack on some of these kind of big demolitions off the back of defensible space, and have a rethink about what it might think. But I think it's just beginning. I think it's really interesting how the story ebbs and flows and in different parts of the world in different ways.
And certainly we end the book, the last sort of like chapter picks up half a dozen, I guess, design misperceptions. And that's because I think we're starting to see where that change is happening. And one of those is this idea of, you know, pseudo public spaces, and how we know that that isn't working, and everybody was becoming very sort of like suspicious of it, and that, you know, that attempt to avoid segregated public realm. And, you know, we may talk about buffer zones, but what actually do they mean? You know, transitional thresholds, this thing about actually having to renegotiate what you actually mean it. You know, I work up near where the GLA building is, and the public realm there has been, it's been altered and changed really dramatically over the past 5 years, and we're revisiting that. I think there's also something, and we mentioned at the very beginning, how much defensible space is so much about people and the numbers of people and the, you know, the pressures of, you know, the reliance on, I guess, mechanical, not natural surveillance, and the more people increasing pressures on territoriality, and this idea of permeability, and how many people around is a good thing, and how many people is too much. And so I think we started to sort of really question some of, you know, some of those design rules, some of that sort of determinism around that. And that recognition that maybe so many things like the figures of density and thresholds, they're all really, really relative. And we do have to rethink about how they're being used at the same point.
In a way, I think there's kind of a dearth of research. So, for example, the idea of eyes on the street, like how many eyes on the street works and, you know, what doesn't work. And I think one of the things that's happening with, you know, new thoughts around walkable cities and the kind of greening of cities is rethinking public space as more walkable, more publicly accessible, but at the same time trying to make it a public space that is safe. And I suspect that there's going to be this weird kind of, you know, kind of blending of kind of, you know, the walkable, bikeable city push, along with rethinking and renegotiating what public space is and what it might mean and who's on that street and who's protecting who.
That's a fabulous point to finish on. Thank you so very much, Loretta. Thank you very much, Eleanor. That was really wonderful to hear you talk about your book.
Thank you. It's been good fun.
Thank you. That was really interesting questions. Really got me thinking.
We remain no closer to answering the question as to whether one can effectively throw a jelly sandwich out of a 20-story tower, but I think we shone some light on the issue. Thank you to Loretta and Eleanor for taking the time to speak with me, and to Wiley for the book. See the podcast description for links to their social professional profiles and to the book. And thanks for listening.